John and Ruth Dirksen are heading up Reasons to Believe Canada. So they maintain our office up there, and they're going to be taking some books back with them as they drive back home. But it's been fun having them here this past week. So my son just got this email, and I thought I'd read it to you. An elderly man lay dying in his bed. In death's agony, he suddenly smelled the aroma of his favorite chocolate chip cookies. My son really loves chocolate chip cookies. Wafting up the stairs, he gathered his remaining strength and lifted himself in the bed. Leaning against the wall, he slowly made his way out of the bedroom and with even greater effort forced himself down the stairs, gripping the railing with both hands as he went. With labored breath, he leaned against the doorframe, gazing into the kitchen. Were it not for death's agony, he would have thought himself already in heaven. There, spread out upon wax paper in the kitchen table, were literally hundreds of his favorite chocolate chip cookies. Was it heaven, or was it one final act of heroic love from his devoted wife, seeing to it that he left this world a happy man? Mustering one great final effort, he threw himself toward the table, landing on his knees in a crumpled posture. His parched lips parted. The wondrous taste of the cookie was already in his mouth, seemingly bringing him back to life. The aged and withered hand trembled on its way to a cookie at the edge of the table when it was suddenly smacked with a spatula by his wife. "Stay out of those," she said. "They're for the funeral." So, now you know what kind of humor my son Joe likes. So, I promised I'd read it to you, so I did. I fulfilled my obligation. Another announcement, by the way, I just want to repeat once again, our kind of our new structure for this class is there's kind of a field report. We quickly give that. We talk about a new scientific discovery. Then we spend the rest of the time on one of our creation texts we're working through. But one other announcement I wanted to give you is that after a year and a half, I have finally updated our design papers that we posted at our reasons.org website. And you'll find them posted up next week. We're going to be presenting them at this Intelligent Design Conference in Biola. And if you go to our website, you notice we've been posting them like every year. And you get to see how, as astronomers learn more and more about the universe, we see the evidence for our solar system and universe being designed for life and human beings in particular becomes progressively greater and greater. And this last 18 months, we've seen the biggest jump of all. What we posted 18 months ago was a list of 48 different laws of physics and constants of physics that had to be fine-tuned for life to be possible anywhere in the universe. And the current list that we just updated yesterday, 64 characteristics. So it's gone from 48 to 64 in just the last 18 months of research. But the most dramatic increase of all was looking at all the characteristics of the solar system and our galaxy that must be fine-tuned for life to be possible on planet Earth. And back 18 months ago, we had listed 202 characteristics. The new list is 319. And whereas 18 months ago, the probability was less than one chance in 10 to the 217. It's now less than one chance in 10 to the 277. And actually, the probability was 10 to the minus 120 less, but we made some very generous allowances for dependency factors. Not all the factors we listed are strictly independent of one another, which means you can't just multiply the probabilities together. But even being really conservative on this, less than one chance in 10 to the 277 that you're going to find a body anywhere in the universe with a capacity to support life. And so bottom line, what it means is the evidence has just gotten 10 to the 60 times stronger that the God of the Bible created our solar system for the benefit of life and human beings in particular than it was 18 months ago. And it's like, you know, where else can you go in Christian apologetics and get a factor of a trillion, 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 trillion in just 18 months of research? However, I must be honest about this. I think one reason why we accumulated so much more in the last 18 months than in previous attempts on this It's just because we're being a little more diligent in reading the literature, and we're still not reading all the relevant literature. But I'd like to share with you one piece from the recent literature. I got this just 2 days ago, the latest issue of Astrobiology, and the lead article in the magazine is something I've been waiting for over 2 years. Fuzz and I actually write about this in our new book. By the way, I should tell you, this book got released just a couple of days before Easter, so it's available for the first time today. But we have a couple of chapters there that deal with what are called extremophiles. And if you haven't heard that term, it refers to life that likes extreme conditions. And so if you ever went up to, say, Yellowstone National Park, you'll find these percolating pools of water that's near the boiling point. And in that water, there are bacteria. And so those would be thermophiles, life forms that like things really hot. And then you've got life forms that like things really cold, and life forms that like things that are very salty, very acidic, or highly alkaline. We call those things extremophiles. And one of our colleagues referred to Michael Jackson as an extremophile, but that's really not relevant. Actually, what we notice is that all the extremophiles are bacterial life forms. So you really don't see extremophiles that really go beyond the bacterial life forms, although there are some near the steam vents at the bottom of the ocean. And one thing we wrote about in our Origins of Life book is that the extreme nature of the conditions may not be as extreme as we think. For example, you find life that likes very high temperatures, but they're high temperatures under high pressure of water. And what we realize is that the boiling point goes up when the pressure goes up, and the freezing point goes up when the pressure goes up. And so in terms of where the life form is in between freezing and boiling, it's roughly the same as it is under the conditions that we live in. So they may not be as extreme as they think. But the title of this article, a really grabbing title, Extremophiles May Be Irrelevant to the Origin of Life. And Rudy addresses this new move by NASA and the Astrobiology Program, which is to make note of the fact that we find these bacterial life forms under incredibly harsh or extreme conditions here on planet Earth. And therefore, they're rather enthusiastically presuming that if we find harsh conditions like that elsewhere in the solar system, that too would be a candidate for life. And this article is basically saying that's misguided thinking. And it's misguided thinking because although you can find Earth life forms that live under these harsh conditions, it's impossible for that life form to originate under those conditions. And so in that context, they say this is irrelevant. You know, if you find a place on Europa, for example, where you've got liquid water, he said that's not a place where life can exist because there's no possibility for life to evolve under the European Ocean. And the point they make in the article with respect to Europa, for example, is that all origin of life scenarios require the evaporation of water. And how can you evaporate water on Europa's ocean when it's underneath this thick layer of ice? There's no opportunity for air to make contact with the water, and therefore the whatever prebiotics would be there would remain extremely dilute, and the origin of life would be impossible. And it's an interesting paper because they go through actually every single form of extremophile and explain in each case why the origin of life would be impossible under those conditions. I'll read you just a couple. They talk about salts. And they said the problem with a salty environment is that the molecules that are necessary to make even the most primitive membranes will not form under salty conditions. And so you'll never get the membrane coming together. Likewise, you can't get RNA forming under these salty conditions. And then with respect to very acidic conditions or highly alkaline conditions, the sugars that make up the backbone of the RNA and the DNA likewise will not form. And then again, with high temperatures and low temperatures, you're not going to get stability in the RNA and the DNA. So the bottom line is, if you want life to have any possibility of originating, it's got to take place under benign conditions. And if you do have extremophiles, it's only because those extremophiles followed what you would call the mesophiles. Mesophiles are the life forms that like, you know, exceptionally benign conditions. Last sentence in the paper is, says some planetary bodies, despite possessing environments compatible with the existence of life, do not and never did harbor environments compatible with the origin of life, and thus are sterile. So it says if it's got extreme conditions and it's lacking the mesophile conditions, then that's a body that will be sterile. But yeah, Fuzz and I have been waiting for somebody to publish something like this for at least the last 2 years, and we thought we were going to be the first to put out in print. Actually, we probably are. I think we predated this by about 1 or 2 weeks. But if you want to read more, it's in this Origins of Life book. By the way, this book will be coming out in early June, A Matter of Days, the one that deals with the young Earth, old Earth thing. And both of these books take a whole new perspective that we're launching at Reasons to Believe, which is instead of getting into big battles with the evolutionists or the young Earth creationists, we simply put it to the test. And this is our first book where we actually take, say, the origin of life issue, and chapter by chapter we would lay out the predictions on, say, extremophiles or homochirality or the synthesis of the RNA and DNA. And we say from a naturalistic perspective, these are the predictions you would be forced to make. From a biblical perspective, these are the predictions you would make. And let's just see whose predictions have come true based on the research of the past 5 years. Then we make predictions about what should come true in the next year or two. And so you can see how well the two models have done chapter by chapter, but also you can put it to the test. You wait a year or two and see how well the predictions for future research have come to bear. And that's something we're doing, by the way, with these lists we have on the design of the universe and the solar system. You know, we're right about our biblical cosmic creation model. The evidence should become progressively stronger for our case. But if the atheists are right, then the evidence should become progressively weaker. And so we're going to be rolling this out at this Intelligent Design Conference in Biola. And one thing that Ross didn't say, what's unique about this conference at Biola is they've invited some of the leading atheists to come and speak as well. And so you're going to hear some of the antagonists towards the intelligent design paradigm present their case. So hopefully it's going to encourage intelligent design proponents to take the criticisms they've been receiving more seriously. In fact, that's how I'm going to launch out my talk, is actually address the criticisms and show a better way that we can answer those criticisms. Okay, let's spend some time looking at the book of Job. And we've been in the 37th chapter. And if you haven't been with us in a while, and none of us have been here for the last couple of weeks, what we've been doing is we are trying to finish up this creation account in Job. And you know, the creation account starts in chapter 34 and goes all the way to chapter 41. This is the longest creation account in the Bible, and we're kind of smack in the middle of this creation account. And if you're new to the class, what we've been doing is going through the entire Bible and spending time examining all 20 of the creation accounts in the Bible. I think this is, what, number 7 or 8 that we've done, so we're not quite halfway through all the creation accounts of the Bible. But what we've been doing is looking at the last half of chapter 36 and all of chapter 37. And the reason we focused on this chapter and a half is the entire chapter and a half written by, or Elihu here is speaking. And Elihu is addressing Job and his three friends with the theme of water. He says you can understand who God is and the characteristics of God just by looking at water. Water by itself will testify of the wisdom, the love, the care, the power, the creativity of your Creator. And it's interesting that, you know, from the context of 3,000 and 4,000 years ago, water was such a powerful apologetic tool for laying out God's divine characteristics. But today it's much more powerful, and there's a lot in this chapter and a half that the scientists have yet to uncover and explore and explain. But we've been kind of going through this, and I'll just pick you up where we just left off as we were starting in chapter 36. Verse 22 and following, the things we've been noting here that the text talks about that Elihu addresses is that, number one, water evaporates in the just right amounts and rates for all life, human beings and all of their life. And number two, water condenses in just the right amounts and rates for the benefit of all life. So it starts off by addressing, in general, the water cycle. And then point three, clouds of the just right kind, sizes, and amounts form so as to distribute abundant rain on all of mankind. This is something that scientists have just recognized in the past few years, is that the storm and cloud structure of planet Earth is very exquisitely designed so that rainfall falls everywhere. Just the way the continents are oriented, the way you got the jet streams flying, the way the El Niños are set up, it all works to distribute rainfall over as much of the planet as is possible so that all mankind can receive an abundance of rain, assuming, of course, we don't waste it. Number four, the design and the spreading out of the clouds is highly fine-tuned, and, you know, again, from a modern scientific perspective, this would have to do with the temperature budget of the whole planet. Clouds play a critical role in ensuring that the temperature of the planet remains at the just right level and doesn't go through extremes. You all know what it's like when it's not cloudy for a couple of weeks at a time in the Los Angeles area. It gets quite warm here. And we welcome the clouds because it brings back the temperatures that are more enjoyable, like we're discovering today. Number five, the quantity and sizes, that is, the power levels and the geographical distribution of lightning bolts, is just right so as to provide abundant food for all nations. It's interesting how this text, written 3,500 years ago, talks about lightning in the context of food. And it was only 100 years ago that scientists really understood the role that lightning plays in providing us with an abundance of food. Lightning plays a critical role in nitrogen fixation, taking nitrogen in the atmosphere and fixing it in the soil where the plants can use it. And really what limits the production of food on the land is how much nitrogen can be fixed in the soil, and the lightning plays a critical role. So, as it says here, sometimes the ancients looked at lightning as being something very terrifying, but Elihu makes the point that it's part of God's bountiful provision. Number six, the atmosphere, mountains, hills, soils, and vegetation are designed so that lightning will produce thunder peals that serve to warn both humans and animals of impending storms so that they have time to take cover. You know, it's interesting how you could design a planet where you wouldn't hear thunder, or you would only hear the thunder when it's just upon you. But the way God has designed the storm systems here on planet Earth is that if you're going to get a lightning storm with lots of rain falling down, lightning bolts that could be damaging things, you get a warning. I mean, because it takes time for the storm to advance. And because the lightning is so loud, God has designed the mountains and the hills and the atmosphere in such a way that even if the storm is 20 miles away, you do get to hear the thunder. Now, it may be more difficult and challenging for those of us that work in office buildings that are airtight and well insulated, but put yourself in the context of people who lived 3,500 years ago. You're out in the field, you probably would get almost an hour warning before the impending storm. You're sitting in a downtown office building, might be more like 10 minutes, but hey, you're already in a sheltered place, so you're okay. But the whole point is it gives the animals, as well as the people working the fields, time to, you know, pack up their stuff and take cover. And the point that Elihu makes is the animals are aware of this and they take cover. Likewise, we human beings can stop our plowing and take cover. Number seven, God has designed thunderstorms so that all the earth receives adequate numbers and sizes of bolts. Again, nitrogen fixation. Some regions receive more than others. That's because some regions need more than others. We happen to live in an area where we don't get a lot of bolts. God has designed thunder so that everyone in all circumstances can hear it and take warning. Discussed that already. Number nine, God has designed the earth and the weather patterns so that the just right amounts of snow fall in the just right locations to maximally benefit humans and all life. God has designed both the earth and weather patterns so that storms of just the right intensity, number, and duration would take place. And the whole point here is that, I think I made mention of this earlier, as you look at, say, North America, And what do you notice is that the Cordillera range of mountains, the mountains that go down the backbone of North America, typically get higher and higher as you go closer and closer to the equator. So even the mountains in Mexico get snow on them. Whereas the mountains in the Canadian Rockies don't get so overwhelmed with snow that it causes a problem. I mean, they're typically only 8,000 feet high. But because it's Canada, they get quite an adequate snowpack, even though they're only 8,000 feet high. And then you come down into Washington, and they're like 10,000 feet high, and they get a snowpack. Down here in California, they're 14,000 feet high, and you get a snowpack. You know, one of the things that fascinated me when I came to California for the first time was to discover that California is the only state in the contiguous United States that has valley glaciers. That's because our mountains are so much higher than mountains elsewhere in the country. So the state of Washington doesn't have valley glaciers. We have a valley glacier here up in the Palisades range of the High Sierras. And it's a fun place to go. But because of that, California is a snowpack that allows water to be available all year round. I mean, if all we had was rain and no snow, then there'd be problems. Snow has the capacity of storing water for release at a later time. So that means you need mountains high enough to ensure that you're going to have a storage of snow so it doesn't all melt all at once. Well, kind of where we're at right now is the very bottom, verses 5, 6, and 7 of chapter 37. God's voice thunders in marvelous ways. He does great things beyond our understanding. Part of the thunder is to just cause us to ponder and say, you know, all this damage we're getting from the lightning. I mean, most of the fires that take place naturally are due to lightning bolts. And this is partly to cause men to seek understanding. So we see this thunder, we hear the thunder, we see the lightning, we see the damage that takes place. Hopefully this motivates us to seek understanding and say, why would God do this? He says to the snow, fall on the earth, and to the rain shower, be a mighty downpour. And when you get lightning, usually a mighty downpour follows. So that all men he has made may know his work, he stops every man from his labor. I kind of want to dwell on that point a little bit, that one of the benefits of these storms that we see as so threatening is that they force us to stop our work. Now, again, I want to put this in context. It forces us to stop our work up until, say, what, 1945? Once you get into a really high-tech civilization, it doesn't matter. You can drive your car in a raging thunderstorm, and it makes no problems. I mean, your wipers are adequate. Your tires can do it. But if you were driving a car in the 1920s, you had to pull over and stop and wait for the storm to go away. Today, we don't have to stop. But up until the latter half of the 20th century, storms of this nature literally did force us all to stop. What's the benefit of all this? So that all men he's made may know his work, he stops man from his labor. The animals take cover, they remain in their dens. The tempest comes out from his chamber, the cold from the driving winds. And all this is so that God can show his love and that men can ponder and consider his love. And this is the whole point here. He stops man from his work so that we can look out and realize this is the hand of God, and we can begin to meditate on what God has done so that all men he has made may know his work. And so we need time to ponder, to consider, you know, what is, hopefully to get curious enough to try to figure out why God would do this way, what's the benefit in all this. We have some understanding on this, but I'd like to make a suggestion here that maybe one of the problems plaguing modern society is we're never forced to stop from our work and to rest and consider and meditate. And you know, one of the things about storms is that sometimes it forces you to rest where there's literally nothing to do except to meditate on how great and wondrous this God is. And maybe you can think back to your childhood, those of you that are old enough, when you had these really big storms. What did kids used to do? Gather around by the window and kind of watch and look out at all this great stuff. And that was really, you know, part of the meditation thing. God is forcing us to meditate and say, wow, look at all this weather out here. I wonder why God is doing this. And really begin to consider how marvelous God is and what his work is all about. However, I'd like to suggest we do have a problem today, namely that we see a big storm like that and we just keep plunking away in our computer. Yeah, I got my surge protector here, No need for me to stop my work, and we just keep on going. You know, I'm living in a building or a home where, you know, no matter how bad the storm gets, it's going to hold up. You know, it's set up to handle an earthquake of magnitude 8. So no matter what God does, no matter what kind of act or storm takes place, I'm never forced to stop and consider. Don't even have to run down to the tornado shelter or anything. I mean, everything is just fine. But the problem with that is we keep working and working and working, and we never stop and meditate on God until we reach the time like this gentleman was talking about here, where he was smelling the cookies, right? Only then do you really have the time to consider, and sometimes it's just too late. And that's really one of the things that Elihu is saying here, is that God forces us to stop our work so we can meditate on the things that are most important in life. But, you know, today most of us have jobs that we kind of like. And when you're working at a job you really like, and it's the situation where you never have to stop and rest, that means that you may never take the time to consider what God is doing in your life. And you need to do that more than once or twice. I mean, that's the principle of the Sabbath. But again, I'd say that's one of the plagues of modern society. We really don't obey the Sabbath the way people did 200-300 years ago. You know, we literally take the whole day off. You know, it's interesting how people get 2 days off a week now instead of 1 day off a week, but we have less rest than people who used to take 1 day a week off. You know, you get your 2 days off, but guess what? There's all this stuff you got to do to maintain the household and keep things going. And so maybe your rest day is just spending a couple of hours at church, and that's it. You go back to your work and your business. And I'd like to suggest, too, that maybe the worst offenders of this are Christian leaders. I just personally feel a strain of just having to work all the time just to keep up with the demands of the Reasons to Believe ministry. And this is one of the things I really appreciate about the way we've set up Reasons to Believe is right from the very beginning, 17 years ago, we did make it a point that once a quarter we would have a day of prayer and fasting. And no matter how busy things got, we would take that day. I can tell you, though, the longer the ministry persists, the more challenging it is to put that time aside to fast and pray. But maybe this is something we all need to be doing as believers, is just recognize that society is structured in such a way that we can ignore the weather, we can ignore the storms, we can ignore the forced rest, and we just keep on going. But according to Job here, Job 37, this is something we all need. And we're not forced to take rest, so we need to force ourselves to take rest. And when we do take a rest, to make sure it's a time that we really spend meditating upon the Lord. And I'll just tell you a couple of stories that have happened in my own life about this. Because I think one of the benefits of a storm when you're out there is that there are really things that you really got nothing else to do but to meditate upon God. And maybe then another thing I could encourage you to do is sometimes it's good just to expose yourself to the conditions that Job and Elihu and his three friends faced, which means you're out there in the world, and you're out there without a tent or whatever, and then you have to really deal with the elements. And maybe that's one reason why backpacking is so popular amongst modern people. It kind of takes you back to those days when you're a little more subject to the elements. And one of the places where I really love to go backpacking is up in the Canadian Rockies, but unlike the High Sierras, the weather is quite a bit more inclement than it is here in California or even in the Rockies in Colorado. And so when you go there, it's on the advanced knowledge that you might wind up spending 2 or 3 days in your tent while an August blizzard goes through. And, you know, here we never get a blizzard in August, but in the Canadian Rockies that can happen. And there was one time I was in the Bugaboos in southern British Columbia, and, you know, it was the 5th of August, and a blizzard came up, and it didn't let up for 2 whole days. So here we are, you know, at 8,000 feet. You look outside, all you can see is snow, and it's pretty miserable. You're in this little tiny tent. But I came equipped. I brought my Bible with me, and that's when I began to do this in-depth study of the book of Revelation, and that was the birth of the seven-year tribulation we had here in the class where we went through the entire book of Revelation, okay? But I want to tell you, those 2 days in the blizzard didn't do it. I had another 2 days when, again, I was up in the Canadian Rockies, and this time we were in Assiniboine, and it wasn't a blizzard. But it was 2 days of nonstop hard rain. And actually, that was more miserable than the snow, because things get muddy and, you know, the tent starts leaking and so forth. But that's kind of where I was able to finish up the second half of that Revelation study. But, you know, and, you know, what else could you do? You're sitting in a tent. You got, what, maybe 12 square feet of space and everything there. I mean, you really can't move around much. And so you get out your Bible and you study your Bible and you begin to pray and begin to meditate. God literally takes away all other options but that, but that's something we really need. And it's something that I think all of us really struggle making time for. It's a hard struggle to make time to spend extended time to meditate upon the Lord and to meditate upon His Word. And again, I want to just to encourage you to think about that. And what I mean by extended time, really think about devoting an entire day. You know, how many times in your life do you get a chance to do that? I think, you know, 21st century Christians, we think of, well, I'm going to spend 15 minutes. And it's great to spend 15 minutes a day. But you need those times when you spend a lot more time than just 15 minutes. You'd be amazed what can happen in your life when you spend a whole day. Now, when I've suggested this to Christian audiences and other churches, they say, what do you do for a whole day? I mean, you know, the idea of just spending a whole day meditating upon the Lord, they say, well, you know, when I get through my 10 minutes, I'm exhausted. I've done everything. What else can I do? What else can I pray about? Well, that's when you go to this book. If you want to really stimulate some good prayer time with the Lord, just start reading this. And you need to read large chunks of it if you're really going to hear what the Lord has got to say for you. And so if there's an issue in my life where I really face a difficult decision, what I try to do is take some extended time and just read. And sometimes it takes many hours before you come across a passage or a time of prayer where you really get the insight you need to make a wise decision. But the whole point is, in the days of Job, you had to do that. The weather forced you to do that. Today we have to discipline ourselves to take time off from our busy schedules to make that happen. So, word of exhortation here. Okay, verse 8. The animals take cover, they remain in their dens. The tempest comes out from its chamber, the cold from the driving winds. The breath of God produces ice, and the broad waters become frozen. This is the first mention of ice in the whole chapter and a half here. He loads the clouds with moisture, he scatters his lightning through them. At his direction, they swirl around over the face of the whole earth to do whatever he commands them. He brings the clouds to punish men, or to water his earth and show his love. And this is also the first mention of how God uses the water cycle to reward and to punish people upon the face of the earth. You know, what I wrote down here is that number 11, God has designed water, the earth, and weather systems so that anywhere in the world he can use weather to reward and punish human beings. And again, it's marvelous the way God has set up the weather patterns so that if he wants to bless the people, he can do it any time. And if he wants to punish them, he can do it any time. And if you want a good example of this, just read through the historical books of the Old Testament, particularly 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. You'll find many examples there where God blesses the righteousness of his people by rewarding him with rain at the right time so that they get these bountiful crops and the land is in blossom and blooming. But he also is able to punish the foes of Israel and the Israelites when they're rebelling against him by withholding water or dropping the water all at once. And, again, we live in a place where we can see that, is that the way the weather systems in California are designed, we could wind up going a long, long time without any moisture at all. But we've also seen instances where in the course of a couple of days, it comes down all at once. And if you get too much water, it's a problem. If you get too little water, it's a problem. And the whole point here, God says, I've designed the clouds in such a way that I can punish whoever I want, anytime I want, anywhere I want. Doesn't matter where in the world you are. The weather systems can be set up in such a way as to discipline anyone that God chooses. But he also says, I've designed the weather systems in such a way that no matter where you are, anytime, anywhere, I can show my love to you by blessing you with great weather, whether that be beautiful sunshine. And, you know, I've been accused sometimes by my wife of praying when we're going on a hike in the mountains that we'd have great weather during the hike, and as soon as the hike was over, the rain would come down so we could see the rain happen. It's, like, it's amazing how many times it works that way. So God can do that, and it's not a sin to ask God to do that. However, you need to take into account people who might need the rain you're saying not to rain. I remember my sons picking up on this, and they were praying that all the rain would fall at night. And I was praying the opposite way because I wanted to get my telescope out. So, you know, you need to think who's being blessed and who's not being blessed and who needs the water, who doesn't need the water. But God says, I have it all under control. And if you pray according to my will, it will happen. And that sense, water becomes a real proof that God is both just and loving. You know, those are the two characteristics of God that Elihu is bringing out here. This, again, in the context, this is the end of the debate that Job is having with his three friends. This young man Elihu puts a stop to the debate. Actually, the Lord does. We're going to pick up the Lord's answer to the debate just the beginning of chapter 38 and following. But Elihu reminds the four men that water is a marvelous proof that God is perfectly just as well as perfectly loving. God has designed the weather patterns and the earth so that the just right amounts of ice form at the just right locations to maximally benefit humans and all life. Now, he's already mentioned snow. Why is he mentioning ice here? Anybody got an idea why we need both ice and snow? What's the difference? Yeah.
Ice lasts
longer. Okay, that's very good. It takes a little bit longer for the ice to melt than the snow to melt. And so, yeah, especially like here in Southern California, it's important that we have both ice and snow. The snow will melt first, but the ice will last longer. And so, you know, come just before the heavy rains fall, the fact that we got ice melting is significant. Anything else? Floats on the surfaces of lakes. Why is that so critical? And rivers. That's it. Keeps the fish alive. So it's important that this ice is a great insulator. And so it prevents the water there from getting too cold to the fish underneath. And by the way, it also stops the predators. You know, I grew up in Canada, so I can remember these bears scooting around the ice trying to get the fish, but they can't get the fish because the ice is there to stop it. So the fish get a chance to recover during the winter from the predators that go after them during those times when the ice isn't there. Yes. Okay, there's another great benefit, ice cores. And this is, it's amazing how God has set up this water cycle to bless people in a way that he hasn't blessed them in the past. Only in the 20th century, last half of this 20th century, in the first part of the 21st century, have we been able to drill down through these ice cores and just see the record of God's beneficence in the past. You know, one of the things we've been writing about at Reasons to Believe is how when you go through these ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica, what you discover is that for the last 10,000 years, we've been living in an exceptionally benign conditions. Previous to 10,000 years ago, all the way back to a million years previous, what you see in the ice cores is that conditions are much more turbulent in terms of the climate. So these past 10,000 years have really been exceptional, and maybe that really explains why the birth of human civilization didn't begin until 10,000 years ago. It's like God knew ahead of time that we're going to have this long, benign climate episode, and so he works things out in such a way that human civilization is launched at the very base of that benign period and continues. By the way, there's a lot of speculation about scientists about how much longer this benign period will last, and estimates run anywhere from maybe 2,000 years to 6,000 years. Maximum would be maybe 7,000 years we got left of this benign window of exceptional climate. What I mean by an exceptional climate is where you've got this very even rainfall without any major disturbances where places get too dry or too wet, and where the temperature is just right for human civilization and global occupation. A command that God gave to Adam and Eve and to the peoples after the flood, multiply and fill the earth. But he gave us those conditions whereby we could actually pull that off. And when you go through the ice cores, you see that those conditions didn't always exist. Comment back here. That is correct. One of the unique features of water is that it's lighter as a solid than it is as a liquid, and therefore floats. And if water didn't float, that our planet would be sterile. So it's really good that God designed water in such a way that it floats. There are other liquids that do the same thing, but they're not very abundant liquids, and they're not like water where it can store heat. You know, water has lots of features that make it really the only possible fluid in which you could have life chemistry operating. I think I reported here in the class about 3 months ago that there was a major conference or workshop sponsored where they said, are there alternatives to water in the context of life? And the bottom line was, no, there are no alternatives. There are other liquids you could go to that have some of the properties of water, but no liquid has all of the properties of water that would make life chemistry possible. You know, some of the other things that are special about water is the way the two hydrogen atoms that splay out from the oxygen allows water to molecules to hook together and actually hook together and drag one another. So one of the unique features of water is that it actually can go uphill or go up walls. I mean, capillary action is there because these water molecules can hook together. And the other thing about rainfall is one water molecule out of 1,000 hooks together to make, what do they call it? I forget the technical name for it, but it's H2O2, where you've got two H2Os hooked together. No, and that's not hydrogen peroxide. It's actually two water molecules that form a molecule, so like a double water molecule. No, it's not heavy water. But these double water molecules are critical for forming raindrops. If you didn't have double water molecules, raindrops wouldn't form, and you wouldn't get the water cycle. And the fact that it forms at a level of about one out of 1,000 water molecules really is one of the design characteristics. Do you have a question, or are you just okay? Go ahead. Well, sublimation is a problem on Mars because on Mars the atmospheric pressure is so much less than it is on Earth. I think it's like less than 6%. That the freezing point of water is identical to the boiling point of water, which means that frozen water on Mars very usually does not go into the liquid state. The only way it goes into the liquid state is if you were to give a sudden heat pulse to a lot of frozen water on Mars, and then it goes liquid for a short time and then evaporates. But more typically, it's like dry ice. You buy dry ice from the supermarket and you put it outside, it doesn't go to the liquid phase, it goes straight to vapor. Likewise, on Mars, water goes straight to vapor and therefore is not available for life on Mars. By the way, you can have liquid carbon dioxide. What you need is an atmospheric pressure a whole lot greater than what we have. Then you would have liquid carbon dioxide. So, yeah, God designed the atmosphere of planet Earth so that water would remain liquid over a broad range of temperatures. How cold is dry ice? Oh, I don't know offhand. Maybe someone else here in the class would know. Yeah, so it's cold. Okay, and question back here? Right, and that would be a problem because the ice would accumulate and eventually all the water would be in a frozen state. So you'd be in real trouble. So it's good that the angle between the hydrogen atoms is exactly what it is. That angle is also what ideally causes these molecules to hook together at just the right rate. So, yeah, water is an amazing molecule. Well, those calculations of how much longer we're going to have ideal conditions here on planet Earth, and a lot of it has to do with the precession of our rotation axis. You know, planet Earth precesses like a top, you know, it's spinning. But as it spins, it goes through this movement like a spinning top, and it's about 26,000 years long. And so, you know, what's going to happen eventually is the planet Earth will be closest to the sun in the northern winter, which means our summers are going to get a lot hotter and our winters are going to get a lot colder. Right now, the way the precession is set, it's such that the northern hemisphere is closest to the sun in the wintertime and farthest from the sun in the summertime. So it makes our summers cooler and our winters warmer, which really a lot beings do not significantly disturb the climate of planet Earth. So yeah, we really start pushing global warming and other atmospheric disturbances that could be a problem. One thing I think we've already done in terms of our disturbances in the atmosphere is that these past 10,000 years we've had conditions whereby the intensity of our storms are particularly low. And I think we're in danger of threatening that. Global warming is hard to factor in because when you burn fossil fuels, the particulates cool the atmosphere, and the greenhouse gases you release warm the atmosphere. And so you've got global warming, but you also have global cooling. And the really good climate models take into account both. And there was a special issue of Nature about a year and a half ago where they looked at about half a dozen climate models that all accurately predicted the past 150 years. And that's a good test. If it can predict past climates and you got hindsight to check out the model, then maybe you can trust it for what's going to happen in the future. They kind of cancel. You got the cooling canceling off the warming. However, the one thing that doesn't cancel is that the particulates that we release typically do not move very much. They go up into the stratosphere and they stay put, which means you get what's called local cooling, whereas when you burn fossil fuels, the water you release and the carbon dioxide you release gets globally distributed. So you get a global distribution of warming, but you get local cooling from the particulates. Bottom line, what that does is it makes for lower air pressure pockets. And lower air pressure pockets means you get more intense storms. So that may be one explanation why over the past 50 years we've seen the intensity of hurricanes, monsoons, and tornadoes increase compared to the historical record. And so that could continue and make conditions less benign than they've been for the past 10,000 years. But global warming and global cooling, the models still aren't to the point where we can say they're really accurate and we can count on them. And the real problem there is we're not able to predict exactly what the burning habits will be of human beings 50 years from now. I mean, it could change quite a bit. Yes. Well, if you want to check out our reasons.org website, we post a new discovery there every day that gives new evidence for the Christian faith. And I think one of the ones that's going up next week is on silicic acid. And it's an experiment that was done off of Iceland. But they said, one of the ways we can deal with global warming is that we will provide more iron to the phytoplankton in the oceans. And if you got more phytoplankton, they'll eat more carbon dioxide and water vapor from the atmosphere. And so that would take care of all the greenhouse gases, or many of the greenhouse gases we're pumping into the atmosphere. They did the experiment, and they found they indeed were able to get this big explosion in phytoplankton and a reduction in carbon dioxide and water vapor and, help the temperature of the planet. But they found it was short-lived, that the phytoplankton that they produced by giving them extra iron rather quickly died. Within a few weeks, it died. And what they discovered was they died because they didn't have the silicic acid to complement the iron. And so bottom line is it's going to take a lot more care and wisdom on our part as human beings to manage the ocean environment in such a way as to rectify our anthropogenic activities. And the paper actually ended with a wise comment, which said it may be more than just silicic acid that's involved. And therefore, this whole idea, well, a quick fix is let's just put more phytoplankton in the oceans. It may not be a quick fix. Moreover, phytoplankton release things. They release aerosols into the atmosphere. They release toxins into the water. And this may not be as easy to fix as we might think. But it also is another design feature, that one of the things God does to provide for life on planet Earth is he provides the just right amounts of iron, but also apparently the just right amounts of silicic acid. And we human beings need to be cautious if we think we're smarter than God and trying to provide for all life on planet Earth. Not that we shouldn't figure it out, but we should be rather humble in realizing It may be more than just iron. There may be other things we have to put into this. Yes, Wes. A little more complex than that. The wobble does have a big impact because, if suddenly it's cold in the northern winter, then you're going to get a greater accumulation of ice and snow over Canada and Siberia. I mean, one quick look at a globe and you can figure out most of the land masses in the northern hemisphere, and the big land masses are there. And you get really big land masses, they're more likely to accumulate snow and ice. So it is a big factor. But other factors you also need to take into account is that the eccentricity of the orbit of Earth as it goes around the Sun also varies. And what I mean by eccentricity is the egg-shaped nature of our orbit. Planet Earth's orbit is very nearly circular, but it's slightly elliptical. And the ellipticity of our orbit varies like on a 41,000-year cycle. And then the inclination of our orbit relative to the plane of the solar system has got a 100,000-year variation. And so you've got a 100,000-year cycle, a 41,000-year cycle, and then you've got this 26,000-year cycle. You've got another cycle that's much, much longer, and that's the fact that the point where the Earth is closest to the Sun, that also varies over an extremely long period of time. So that begins to move. But what you can do, and you can do this with the ice core thing, you go down through the ice cores, and you can see the record of what kind of climate you had at different times. And every once in a while, you get the wobble lining up with the eccentricity variation, lining up with the inclination variation in such a way as to give you an extremely cold condition or extremely hot conditions on the Earth. And you can see that by going through these core drills. It's a major factor, but not the only factor. Well, for example, 11,000, 12,000 years ago, the wobble was such that we were closest to the Sun during the summertime. And so that's when we had a big ice age. You know, the last ice age ended about 11,000, 12,000, 13,000 years ago. But that's right when the wobble was putting us closest to the Sun in the summertime and farthest away from the Sun in the wintertime. So we're at the ideal point right now, where we're closest to the Sun in the summertime. So in terms of, when in that window of time conditions are the most benign of all, it's right now. But it is interesting. This is also when we've got affluence, technology, and civilization at their peak. So, yes. Not the past 10,000 years has been exceptionally benign. Well, I would put the God's creation of Adam and Eve somewhere between 40 and 50,000 years ago. So in terms of the time window, that's, quote, most of humanity. But in terms of the population level, it's a rather tiny amount. Most of the people that ever lived have been living over the past 10,000 years. Vast majority have been living over the past 10. So the human population wasn't that great until the launch of civilization 10,000 years ago. So, in terms of humanity, the vast majority of us have been experiencing exceptionally benign conditions. Incidentally, there's a fifth factor in all this, and that's the fact that the Sun has had exceptionally stable luminosity for the past 50,000 years, and that will continue for another 50,000 years. Neutrino studies have revealed that the Sun is in its most stable luminosity phase in its entire 4.5 billion year history. So for the past 4.5 billion years, things haven't been that great in terms of the Sun, but 50,000 years ago, it went into its most stable phase. The Sun is the most stable star, and right now, it's in its most stable phase of burning. So, the Sun itself testifies to God's beneficence upon us. And if you're curious and want to know how much longer the Sun is going to be exceptionally benign, we got 50,000 more years to go. And then it's going to not be so nice. Okay, there's a question in the back. Comment? That's it. That's correct. Well, that's the whole point, is that the tilt of the rotation axis is what causes our seasons. Right. So the tilt of the axis is a bigger effect than how far away we are from the Sun. But the whole point is the two cancel one another off to some degree, because of where we are in the wobble of the Earth's rotation. Okay, no. The wobble, Okay, it's at 23.5 degrees, and that's quite stable. But what I mean by the wobble is it's rotating like this, and then like this, and then, so it's always at 23.5 degrees, but it's going through this, the wobble kind of tilts around like this over 26,000 years. Like a top, yeah, like a spinning top. But the angle stays the same. Well, the difference is if it's wobbled this way, then when it's winter in the north, you are closest to the sun. But if it's wobbled this way, then you know, come winter time, you're farthest away from the sun. So that's the difference. The angle does change, but by very tiny amounts. There's a slight variation in the tilt of the rotation axis, but the climatologists typically ignore it because it has such a very slight effect. Things like the ellipticity, the inclination, and the wobble are the big effects. Okay, have I been missing any hands here? Sometimes I look over one side and that's it. We got a question here? Yeah. No? Right. Right. Yeah, and sometimes the ratio is 10 to 1, that a cubic meter of ice will have 10 times the water of a cubic meter of snow, if it's fresh fallen snow. So that is a good point, that you can store more water per unit volume with ice than you can snow. Yeah. Right. Right. Well, that's a big factor in the Canadian North. They do all their transportation in the wintertime. And it's always a little bit risky to be driving the last truck across the Great Slave Lake. They lose one or two. So, yeah, those guys are well paid. Come May and June when it's just about to melt, they get a little more pay than they do in January where it's guaranteed it's not going to melt. But yeah, I mean, look in the Canadian North. This is also true of Siberia. You've got these enormous lakes. And, you really don't want to try to travel in the summertime because everything is mud. But in the wintertime, everything's frozen. And you can take a shortcut right across the lake instead of, you know, driving four times longer. So it's actually done. They got highways going across these frozen lake expanses. There was another question here? No? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's what you would call an urban legend. It's not true. But that story is really prevalent. It's been prevalent for a good 100 years. That the rotation axis tilted in such a way that you had this sudden change in climate that explains these mammoths being frozen in place with food still in their stomach and even in their mouth. The truth of the matter is, if you've got any very large landmass at a high latitude, you're going to get what they call Chinooks or reverse Chinooks. My father grew up in Alberta, and he always told me stories about these Chinooks. And what a Chinook is the wind that blows across the Canadian prairies where the temperature will jump up as much as 100 degrees in 30 minutes. Okay? And you've probably experienced them. I've experienced them. Right. Now, my dad didn't tell nearly as many stories, however, about reverse Chinooks. You get reverse Chinooks just like you get Chinooks, where wind comes in and the temperature will plummet by 100 degrees in the space of a few hours or less. And, the greater the land mass and the higher the latitude, the more dramatic the effect. So in southern Alberta, you said, 4 hours? But if you go to northern Alberta, it's much more rapid than 4 hours. And so in Siberia and in Canada, you do find the remains of animals that are literally frozen in place. They've even found animals that are frozen where a foot is up. You know, that the animal doesn't even get time to drop its foot before it's frozen in place. So, and again, there's food in their mouth and so forth. So that's just something that happens. When you've got a big land mass at a high latitude, you can get very sudden changes in temperature. It happens, yeah. So it happens in real time. With people, they feel the cold and they put a jacket on, but animals are not quite able to do that.
or even to adjust their metabolism. I mean, what you do when it gets really cold is you just start pushing your metabolism up. But if you're a woolly mammoth, you cannot adapt that fast. And so you will be frozen in place. So, which is why the Canadian government is able to serve mammoth meat at their estate functions. Even though the meat's 8,000 years old, no problem. It's still good to eat. And so they serve it up. So, freezer burn. Okay, next week, let's see if we can finish this Job 37. I got about six more benefits of the water that God has provided here for us. So I'm going to encourage you to read, well, let's read from verse 10 down to the bottom. And really what's going on in this passage, what I have you look for, is that Elihu really nails down the theme about no natural evil. I mean, that's a big philosophical debate today. In fact, I know it's going to come up at this Intelligent Design Conference at Biola, that there's, quote, natural evil out there in the world in addition to moral evil. And I think this is a good passage to go to where it just says, that's not what's going on here. You know, hurricanes are bad, tornadoes are bad, and lightning is bad. But you know what? God has given us the ideal amount of lightning. So we shouldn't be referring this as natural evil, but rather as evidence of God's optimal design for our personal benefit. He doesn't give us too much lightning. He doesn't give us too little lightning. Likewise, he doesn't give us too many tornadoes or too few tornadoes. So next time we get together, I'll explain to you why it's important that you get a few tornadoes, why it's important that you get a few hurricanes. And it'd be real easy for God to get rid of hurricanes and tornadoes. Just rotate the planet a little more slowly, but then you'd be suffering from many more acts of God than you would if we had the tornadoes and hurricanes. And incidentally, you can extend that to things like cancer too. I mean, we look at all these things that take place in our natural realm, and it's so easy for us to say, this is evil. And this must be something that God's doing to us because we're sinners. And again, you can go to New Testament theology. God does not do bad things to you in terms of natural disasters because we're sinners. Rather, these are things that are in the natural realm because God wants to bless us and provide us and show his love. And so anything that you can identify that you see in the realm of nature that you think is evil, according to Elihu, it's not bad. It's there for your benefit and it's evidence of his love. Although when you're being zapped by a bolt of lightning, sometimes it's difficult to have the emotional state of mind to consider this is all part of God's blessing. So with that, let us pray. Father in heaven, well, we don't want to be glib about these things. You know, the realm of nature is structured in such a way that we do suffer. But thank you that you've given us the words of Elihu to appreciate, although there's suffering in this natural realm, there is overwhelming evidence that you've designed everything for our benefit, our bounty. And Lord, help us realize too that this world is primarily designed to bring about a conquest of evil. And because of that desire on your part to bring about a quick conquest of evil, there are things like gravity and thermodynamics and decay that leads to our suffering. But Lord, with the conquest of evil, you have promised us a new realm with different physics, different dimensions, where there will be no suffering at all. And we won't have any debates over natural evil because none of the suffering will exist anymore. But Father, we thank you that through suffering there is discipline. And through discipline we begin to receive of your righteousness and virtue. And Lord, we look forward to that day when you will completely and totally and utterly remove evil from our realm and bring us into a creation that's far superior to this one. But thank you for Elihu in revealing to us how marvelous and wonderful and the loving is this creation that you provided us to live. Lord, this earth is really an incredible place, a beautiful garden. Thank you for placing us here. In Jesus' name, amen.